Sunstone presents a plenary session entitled Listening Seriously to Jesus, recorded live at the 1986 Sunstone Theological Symposium, held August 20th through the 23rd. We take you to the Salt Lake Sheraton and Towers, where the program is just now beginning.
So that we can begin this plenary session of the Sunstone Symposium. Invite those of you in the rear to please come in and have a seat so we can begin this session of the symposium. My name is Jack Newell, and I'm pleased to chair this plenary session this afternoon. Two announcements that Sunstone has asked me to make here at the outset. One is that the paper David Berger gave on Thursday was given again today. It was not taped on Thursday. It was taped today over the noon hour, and it is now available in tape-recorded form at the back of the hall in the main foyer there. That's the paper on the evolution of the Mormon Temple Endowment, and that paper, that tape, will also be available for the response given by Armand Moss, both to be published later this year in Dialogue. Second announcement is that abstracts of many of the papers that have been given at the conference here so far by Bob Vernon are now available also in the main foyer for a price of 50 cents. They have just become available. As far as I know, those are the announcements which need to be made. It's my particular pleasure to chair this ecumenical session of the conference and to be able to introduce our speaker, a Mennonite who teaches at the University of Notre Dame, Distinguished Catholic University, and has come to Salt Lake City to speak to a group of Mormons. His name is Professor John Howard Yoder. He has been at the University of Notre Dame in the Department of Theology there for about 10 years, and he also has shared and continues to share part of his time at a Mennonite Theological Seminary in Indiana. Earned his Ph.D. in Reformation History at the University of Basel in Switzerland, has been active in the administration of Mennonite missionary activity in Europe and in North and West Africa, particularly in the immediate post-World War II period. He is best known for his book, The Politics of Jesus, published in 1972, in which he urges us to listen carefully to the teachings of Jesus, not with respect to personal ethics, not with respect to our relationships with others, one to another, on an individual basis, but rather to the social ethics of the Savior. His admonitions with regard to our relationships between individuals and institutions, and he has chosen for the keynote of his book, I would quote C.H. Dodd, "The gospel is firmly rooted in a story of that which once happened. The story is familiar, but we should observe that the situation into which Jesus Christ came was genuinely typical. The forces with which he came into contact were such as are permanent factors in history, that is to say, government, institutional religion, nationalism, and social unrest. I am pleased that he has come today to speak particularly to the same theme he addressed in his book, The Politics of Jesus, and the title of his address today is Listening Seriously, to Jesus. I look forward myself to listening seriously to Professor John Yoder as he urges us to listen seriously to Jesus. Please join me in welcoming Professor Yoder to the stand.
I'm very grateful for this ecumenical welcome. I was able to get here over 24 hours ago and to experience something of the shape of your conversations and the communities you come from, for which I'm also grateful. What I was asked to do is to present something of the gist of a 15-year-old book. Some kinds of books can be presented. We heard that done very dramatically yesterday evening in a few minutes. But the kind of study that my book, The Politics of Jesus, represents with a lot of detail cannot really be digested. So I'll try to do something else. I'll try to locate it, to put it on the map, rather than to go through what it says. 19th century America found a lot of new answers to old religious questions, especially two questions, and I call them religious in a kind of capsule designation. And I'll have to use capsule terminology to be brief. The two primary questions, I think, were, what is the right religious organization? That's the first question Joseph Smith asked. It's also the first question George Fox had asked 2 centuries before. And the other is what might be called the cosmic or the Gnostic question: how do we put the Jesus of whom the Gospels speak in the wider framework of the universe, of history and prehistory and post-history, relating to God the Father, the concept of the Trinity, Adam, and all the rest? Those are the two prototypical religious questions to which many Americans, including Mormons in the 19th century, came up with new answers. My point is that they are religious questions, not political. And although the answers were new, the questions were not. They were questions about which Protestants had been arguing for centuries, especially Anglo-Saxon Protestants since around 1600. The answers were new because North America provided space for new answers and an atmosphere for new answers, but the questions were the old questions of Western European religious establishment. In order to argue about those questions, what use was made of the Bible? The texts of the Bible were not generally read for their own sake, the way we read another book for its own sake, asking what the author wants to tell us. They were rather mined for the particular nuggets or the particular diamonds that we could use as proof texts for our debates about the right church or the right gnosis, the right religious wisdom. The first way of putting the challenge which my study put is to suggest that that's a point at which we have something to learn. If we would listen to Jesus, listen also to Luke or to Paul, asking the way we ask about another piece of literature or another teacher's teachings: when did he say that, to whom, why, what did he mean in his own frame of reference? And if we ask that question of the Jesus of the Gospels, we discover that he was not as concerned as 19th century Americans were for knowing which was the right church or which was the right gnosis. That's the first phase of my locating the book. The second phase is to come to grips with the fact that in modern times, not only in our century, but increasingly in recent times, we are aware of the unanswered questions or the wrongly answered questions in the realms of the social or the political. The problems that today are gathered together under the one capsule phrase, liberation. There is nationalism, there is sexism, there is racism, there is materialism. And under the force of these idolatrous powers, we oppress each other and have been doing it for a long time. And we have to ask, because we are neighbors in a crowded world, what can be done about that oppression? And the answer of established religion has usually been, whatever we have to do, it doesn't deal with Jesus, because Jesus is apolitical. Jesus is dealing with precisely the religious agenda. He is dealing with individualism, or he talks to the peasants about the birds and the lilies. He doesn't deal with the real political world, and therefore his answers are not binding for us. My book begins with an inventory of the many ways in which modern Western Christians have said that Jesus is not political. Is that true? Is that true to the text? So what my study does is to go back to the text now that that question has been focused, and go back to it in the mentality indicated by the quote from the New Testament scholar of 2 generations ago, C.H. Dodd, suspecting that that text was written for a political situation, and seeing what we learn if we read it that way. If we read it that way, we learn, as Dodd just said in the text you heard, that the situation into which Jesus came was a very politically tense situation. He came into an oppressed location under the Roman Empire. The Jews, who had been given reason to think that God would help them to have freedom and well-being, were not only oppressed politically, they were also oppressed economically by a very thorough and corrupt taxation system, and they were oppressed religiously because the people who were taking away their national dignity were idolaters, polytheists. The honor of God was at stake, not just the well-being of the Jewish people. And they were looking for a liberation which would be for their community, for their nation, also which would be economic. And rather than try to go through the whole detail of the indices we have of the expectations of the society into which Jesus came, we'll have to limit ourselves with the phrase which you all know very well, because it's in the song that Mary sang when she was told that she was to be the instrument of this blessing coming into the world. She uses what the grammarians call the prophetic perfect. She describes as past what is sure to come. He has shown the power of his arm. He has routed the proud of heart. He has pulled down princes from their thrones and exalted the lowly. The hungry he has filled with good things, the rich sent empty away. That's what God has promised to do through Jesus. That's why the angel told Mary to name him Yehoshua, Joshua, God liberates. That's the mission of Jesus. The first century Palestinian mission, having nothing to do with the American 19th century or with the questions of right religion that radical Protestants had been asking since the British 17th century. Well, if you were Jesus, called to be a liberator in that setting, what would you do? What would your choices be? We can see what the choices of Jesus might have been by looking at the actual social scene, because there were different bodies of people representing the possible social strategies for someone who would want to liberate. There were people whom the text call Sadducees and Herodians, who had unwillingly, but shrewdly, with some moral independence, made their peace with the Roman order. They made the best of a bad deal, and that's always a wise thing to do. They had negotiated with the Romans so they could still have their temple, still have their own temple coinage, so they wouldn't have to bring idolatrous symbols into the temple for their sacrificial services. They had a degree of self-government for their social life within their status as a Roman province. Other people were worse off. They were seeking the dignity of their people by making their peace with the system and working within the system to make the best of a bad deal. That's one of the options if you want to help your people in a situation of oppression. On the other end of the scale, there were people who left. Just about 40 years ago, we started finding many more manuscripts around the Dead Sea to tell us much more about the life of those communities. They left Jerusalem and went out to the desert, not because they didn't care about Jerusalem. They cared a lot about Jerusalem, but they believed that only God could intervene to save his people, and that God would be more likely to intervene to save his people if they were perfectly faithful, and they could be perfectly faithful more easily if they went out to the desert. So they went to the Dead Sea, which is the Great Salt Lake of the Near East, and set up a community where they could keep all of God's rules and be pure and wait for God to be satisfied enough with their purity that he would intervene to reestablish his nation and his people. There was another group of people who likewise kept themselves pure, but they stayed in town to do it. We call them Pharisees, from the root which means to be separate. They continued in economic life, but they had nothing to do with the Romans. They had, therefore, need for a careful set of adjustments and rules and regulations for knowing how you can do that, how you can be in the wider society and still not be contaminated with the worst things that go on there. They were the morally rigorous people within that society, and by refusing to cooperate with the Roman presence, that is the opposite of the Sadducean strategy, they hoped to delegitimize the Roman presence, a word that modern sociologists would use, and maintain Jewish identity until God would intervene. And then there was another group of people, also in the Pharisaic family, but more radical, whom later historians, or they themselves apparently by the end of the century, called zealots, people of zeal, people who, like the Maccabees 2 centuries before, believed that what God wanted them to do was to bring about a righteous revolution themselves. There were people like this before Jesus' birth, every generation at least, there was a group of people like this who represent the force of righteous revolutionary uprising, insurrection against an evil and pagan regime. Our word for that since the 1950s is National Liberation Front. They have existed in Algeria against the French in the 1960s, in Vietnam against the French in the 1950s, in other places, in other times. The same basic phenomenon, a group of people committed to the dignity of their nation who feel morally implicated. If they're Marxist, that's a different value system, but sometimes they are Christian, sometimes they're Calvinist, sometimes they're Catholic, and they believe that the situation is so bad that a violent revolution is, for the glory of God and the redeeming of his people, what they are called to do. Now, of those four strategies, which did Jesus choose? Which would you choose? Most of us, most of the time, choose the Sadducee strategy. We make the best of a bad deal and try not to sell out too badly. Once in a while, some of us take the Dead Sea Community strategy. Some of the flower children of the 60s tried that. Others of us try to stay engaged with the world somehow, but be more rigorous than the Sadducees and keep more carefully from selling out by drawing more firmly the lines of how we will not collaborate with the evil things in our world. There is no indication that Jesus was ever attracted to the strategy of the Sadducees. He was closer to the Pharisees. They were the good people of his culture. That he was closer to them is shown by the fact that he talked more with them. He socialized with them and argued with them. He was talking their language. A sociologist would say he was part of the Pharisaic movement, but ultimately the Pharisees joined with the Sadducees to bring him down because he was not satisfied with their way of staying in the society and keeping their hands clean. Did he go to the desert? Well, he had some relation to John the Baptist, who was out there. There may have been some of that in his past and in his connections, but there is no indication that that was the path that he felt that he, as fulfiller of his calling, was to follow. Especially if we read the Gospel as it's written up by Luke, which is the outline of my first chapter. He set his face toward Jerusalem, is one of the hinges of the Gospel story. Jesus intentionally went to where the power was, to expect and to face and to trigger a confrontation in which he would be the victim. So he's not like the desert community monks. He was closer to the zealots. That's the thing that I discovered when I began the research for this work two decades ago, and it's been richly confirmed by New Testament scholarship since. The presence of the zealot option in his world and in his circle. One of the disciples is simply called Simon the Zealot. If we look carefully, according to the kind of skills that New Testament scholarship brings to bear on these matters, it would appear that half of his disciples may well have been from the zealot circle. And his temptations were zealot temptations. Ways to be king. The tempter takes him to the desert at the beginning of his ministry and shows him three ways to be king. You can feed everybody and have a welfare state, and they'll make you king. Jesus refused it then in the desert, but later he did it, and the devil was right. People wanted to make him king after he had fed the crowd in the desert. That's one of the parts of the zealot temptation. And likewise, at the end of his ministry, Jesus is tempted again in the garden. He prays, asking, if possible, that the fate that stood before him might somehow be avoided. We generally, if we think about that at all, think about the prayer of Jesus and the last hours of Jesus so reverently that it doesn't occur to us to be realistic and ask, what else could have happened? If what we know did happen hadn't happened, what would the alternative have been? What was Jesus praying about as an alternative? What was Jesus tempted by as an alternative? I never found any commentary that asked that question. But you have to if it's a real temptation and if it's real prayer. Jesus was tempted at the very end by the zealot alternative. That would have been the time to trigger the holy war that the zealots among his disciples were waiting for. Peter was there with a sword, and he used it. In rebuking Peter, Jesus tells him, "Don't you know I could have called on 12 legions of angels?" A legion was 6,000 Roman soldiers. I don't know what 72,000 angels would have looked like coming down into that garden. I understand Mormons know more about angels than I do anyway. But it was clear in the thought of the zealots that once the hour struck and the holy war would have been begun, God would give the victory to his soldiers through angelic assistance. That's what Jesus had in mind. That was the alternative that he turned down when he went back to his suffering and to the path which actually he took. But it was the zealot alternative that tempted him. Jesus had the mission to be a liberator, and his temptation was to be a liberator through violence. Righteous violence for a good cause. So in other times and places where morally concerned people see great needs and believe that they are called to contemplate righteous violence for a good cause, that is the decision that Jesus spoke to. We have no indication that creation relationships to the Father, or about exactly what kind of priestly services should take place within the true church centuries later. We do know that he spoke to the question of whether he should be a liberator through violence or through some other means. And what is the other means? It doesn't begin with the cross. It ends in his earthly ministry with the cross. It begins with the creation of a new kind of community. It begins by calling people together, not around the temple, although he and his disciples were faithful frequenters of the temple, and the next two generations of his disciples in Jerusalem continued to use the temple. But what was new was the group of people who in his early months followed him around, disciples in the literal sense of walking after him as he spoke and as he moved from village to village, people who shared their economics with him, they had a common purse, people who learned from him, who remembered the stories he told, the gathering of a new kind of social body. This social body, in later translation in the Greek language, was called church. But it doesn't mean, obviously, not the building. It doesn't mean the hierarchy. It means the gathering. In fact, the word in Greek and the Hebrew and Aramaic words that lay behind it mean an assembly to do business, like a town meeting, like a parliament. It's a gathering not just to be together and not just to look at something or hear something said. It's a gathering to deliberate. That's the ecclesia in Greek culture, and that is the kahal in the Jewish village. That's what Jesus called the group of people following him to whom he gave the responsibility to speak for him in the later history of God's work. That's the new thing that he created. And because of the place of the people of God as a new thing in history, he didn't use the sword. He used instead the cross. I focused on the issue of righteous violence because he did. He had to. That was put to him. But it isn't at all the case that that's the only subject in which we get guidance from the politics of Jesus. There is also in his story, in his teaching, and in his modeling, a different response to the fundamental question of who are inside people and who are outside people. Every society has to define insiders and outsiders. And every society usually does it by having certain privileged people, and the people from the outside matter less. Jesus stood that on its head and gave special privileges to the child, the slave, the foreigner, and the woman. Every society does something about money, something about wealth, usually by having it gathered in the hands of a privileged few. Jesus did something else. He had people share it. They did it that way in his earthly ministry with a common purse, and they did it that way after he was gone with the communal life forms of the Jerusalem congregation, and other kinds of sharing, not the same, but still communal, in the other congregations of the mission of the Apostle Paul. Every society does something about rank, usually by defining a hierarchy of different levels which have different meanings of merit and power. Jesus and his followers stood that on its head by making of the top dog the servant of the underdog. We see this with special clarity in the apostolic writings. After Jesus was gone, they picked this up and carried it on. We have a set of passages in Peter and in Paul talking about social relationships. The call is to mutual or reciprocal subordination. Men, be subject to your wives. Parents, do not irritate your children. Masters, treat your slaves in the knowledge that you have one master. Now, traditionally, these passages have been used because of the parts of the verses I didn't just cite. It says women be subordinate, it says children be obedient, it says slaves accept obedience. But in the social setting where those passages hit people, the important part of the message was the other part. The part that underdogs were given dignity by the fact that the people above them were called to be subordinate to them. So that chapter in my book on that particular portion of the apostolic writings is called Revolutionary Subordination. It isn't the kind of thing that we have learned where in static societies in the American South or today in South Africa, people took this as meaning that a hierarchical society should stay that way because God made it that way. It's the other way around. It's that society has been reversed by Jesus becoming a servant. And the underdog can afford right now not to rock the boat, not to destroy the society, because the persons in positions of responsibility have become servants. Parents have become servants to their children, masters to their slaves, husbands to their wives. That radical reversal of status discrimination is part of the politics of Jesus, part of the social form that Jesus brought. Every society, every political structure has an answer to the question of how you make decisions, usually by having a boss or a few bosses who make them. Jesus, as especially worked out in the Pauline communities, as we have the documents of 1 Corinthians, created another social form of decision, open dialogue. 1 Corinthians 14 says, everybody is to speak, and everybody is to listen. And you haven't reached a decision until that has happened. The model narrative of chapter 15 of the book of Acts shows us the early community working through a specific problem by that mood. Everybody spoke who had anything to say. Some people spoke from the missionary experience of Paul and his friends. Some people spoke from their own experience at having for the first time let a non-Jew into the community. They listened to each other. They listened so much, in fact, that there was a time of silence. They were waiting to see whether anybody else had anything to say. And then finally, the senior local elder of the community, James, stated a viable compromise, a wise human solution to the problem of how Jewish lifestyles and Greek lifestyles could be held together in one community. And of that decision, he says, it seemed good to the Holy Spirit and to us. A decision through the process of open conversation in which everybody can speak. And how everybody can speak is said with special fullness and clarity in 1 Corinthians 12 and 14. Those specimens from Jesus and the early church are only specimens. We can't pick them up and simply lay them on top of another setting in the 19th or the 20th century in North America or in Africa or Asia and be literalists and legalists about how they're going to apply. But they do call us to question deeply, at least, and I would say to reject, the idea that the central concern of Jesus as liberator, as revealer, was to clarify what kind of rituals God wants, or to clarify what kind of information God wants us to have about eternal mysteries, or to clarify what kind of inner experience we ought to have if we want to feel right about the Spirit. Those things aren't wrong. I'm not against them. I cherish those elements of the Western Christian tradition, but they're not what the text is about. When you read the text for what the author wanted to say, those texts are about how God brings about in this world a new kind of peoplehood, a new society living according to the conviction that in those days, just before the middle of the first century of our era, a new kind of fullness came into the world. That the man Jesus, confessed to be the anointed one for whom they were waiting, inaugurated not simply a better level of information, but a new social history and a new political reality. A peoplehood, they call it kingdom, they use political language, so that the modern Western split, which says religion is in this compartment and politics will better be carried on if we can do it neutrally or non-sectarianly. Maybe that's the best way we can run America with all our divisions and confusions. But that is not the way to be following Jesus, because the world that Jesus initiated, the new structure for humans being together, which Jesus began, is more like politics than it is like religion, if we once make the distinction between those two categories. And that's what we find when we read the text straight. Introduction. Maybe I need Jack to protect me or shield the questions or translate them, perhaps.
We do have about 20 minutes for questions, so we should have a good time here together. Who would like to begin? Yes.
That's a good political question. Did I bring copies of the book along? No, I became clear about my itinerary too late to try to get a stack. The publisher is Erdmann's Press in Grand Rapids. It is still in print, although it's 15 years old. And I won't object if you have your bookstore order one. But I didn't bring any along, and there aren't any out there on the tables.
There is at least one copy in the University of Utah Library, because I have it. It'll be back there soon. Yes.
In one of the Gospels, Jesus sends the disciples out. He sends them out to preach. He says, "Before you get back, the kingdom will come." Now, how do you get back during your preaching?
I think you all heard the question. A specific about Jesus sending. He once sent 12 and he once sent 70 in the midst of his earthly ministry, and told them, "Before you get back, the kingdom will have begun or have come." There's a great complexity in the chronological language with which Jesus and then the apostles talk about the coming kingdom as just at the door, at hand, on the way, present. Or that kind of statement that's a future perfect. And then, of course, we have a generation later, the church is going on. They're still in the real world. They're still suffering. So one set of people have said Jesus was expecting something that never happened. He made a mistake. A whole theology started out of that in the heritage of Albert Schweitzer at the beginning of the century. Another set of people said that, well, Jesus was right, but what came was something you can't see, so we need to keep it for later. Some of that in Adventism. I think we must rather admit that there is complexity in the various senses in which that word was verified by what happened later, but that the fact that the kingdom is an inbreaking kingdom was revealed by the way in which the disciples came back and said, "We can throw out devils, we can heal people. The thing is on the road." But the important thing for my purposes is not exactly the chronological precision as to how much of the kingdom was already then present and how much more we have to date with Pentecost and how much with some other time, but that it's a kingdom. It wasn't new information about how to worship or new information about divine mysteries. It was people being helped, healed, people being liberated from possession. It was the creation of a new possibility of human wholeness right there in Palestine those days that Jesus was telling them to be the instruments of. That leaves some fuzziness in our understanding of when it was done or when it was full, and we're still not done. But what's going on is best called a kingdom and not a temple, is best called righteousness and not piety, is best called politics and not religion. Of course, I'm stating that in a polar way in order to irritate you, but because we shouldn't have to polarize. But once we've polarized, that's the way the document lies. Yes?
Well, I'm personally excited about two things you said as it pertains to our church now, and we claim to have the true Church of Christ restored to the earth today. You talk about hierarchy. Translated in our religion, that would be priesthood. Christ is the model of becoming the servant of the people. And we talked a lot here in this symposium about the two types of power and the hierarchy, moving to the service aspect, certainly would follow Christ's political pattern in developing his kingdom or his peoplehood. The other thing was a personal frustration of mine in being a member of this church is that there hasn't been any legitimate sense of forum or feedback from the people. And you reiterated his strategy for making the people was to have, as in Corinthians, everyone speak. And so I'm excited that if we're the restored church, that is the model that we can follow directly from Christ and how he organized his people to give everyone a chance to have an impact on policy and decision making.
That was not a question, but a comment, seeing some pertinence for the LDS context of two of the things that I had mentioned, the way Jesus replaces the power of office with servanthood and centralized decision-making with dialogue. I'm grateful for the opportunity to get acquainted with Mormon history and community a little, but I certainly am the one person here who has the right not to say anything more on that question.
Yes.
The ultimate political aspect of our theology comes, we think of a second coming. One of our prophets once asked the second coming, the burdens and the upheaval in the politics of this world were merely spiritual. His response, gave response yet, just as spiritual as the water was when the flood came. There have been some very heavy-handed literal involvements of God in the history of man. Flood is a great example. In this ultimate cataclysm at the end, you see in Jesus' work, wasn't he really saying that we're going to hold off these legions for a few more years, fellas? We're going to have a day. Or do you see him saying, leave the baby with me, that maybe we'll never have to pull this off that way. Maybe the zealot approach isn't the way that's going to change the world. Maybe Mormon parlance science will come without this cataclysm.
The question is an authentic one that I don't want to claim that my study 15 years ago answered. It's clear that Jesus sets aside the zealot option for the liberation and vindication of God's cause and people in the first century. Some people then thought, and some people today think, that that was a temporary holding operation, and that sometime later God is going to come back after all with a renewed zealot operation, so that the meekness of Jesus, the way of the cross, are a second best option that we have to use in the world until God gets his nerve up again to do it right and to destroy the world the way we think he wants to. That is a powerful strand of North American fundamentalism. In the course of his last electoral campaign, President Reagan referred at least a dozen times to Armageddon as something that he considers to be a political reality. That understanding has to be taken seriously, and I want to take it seriously in ecumenical conversation. But my own conviction is that to take it so seriously as to think that we should be waiting for a time when God would, after all, not be the father of Jesus, not be like Jesus, that Jesus wouldn't be the last word in knowing what the Father wants, is a deep denial of the faith of the early church. And to think that we know somehow better than Jesus what God ultimately wants is to relativize being Christian at all in favor of some other understanding of how a cataclysmic victory of God over all the bad guys would be what God ultimately wants. But that's an authentic debate within the reading of the scriptures, and I don't want to soften it or short-circuit it. My conviction, at least for our age, is that we're to take our signals from the crucified Jesus and not from some other figure who in some other realm might rule with a rod of iron, whatever that can mean after the cross.
Kent.
You see the prophetic tradition of the Old Testament to be similarly political?
Do I see the prophetic tradition of the Old Testament to be similarly political? Certainly in a global sense, although every prophet would have to be read differently for himself as to what he was speaking of. More than we generally realize, I suspect this is a point at which I don't know enough to converse properly with your own reading of the Hebrew Scriptures. The total Hebrew Scripture canon is the story of statehood, kingship, as a way of being God's people, being tried and failing. It failed in two different forms, in the Northern Kingdom and the Southern Kingdom. It's clear in the book of Samuel that when the Israelites first said, "We want to have a king the way the other people have kings," God took that as a setback. He told Samuel, "It isn't you they have rejected. I'm the one they're rejecting." But even then, God was nonviolent. He rode with them. He let his people have their way, but it wasn't the best way. And that it wasn't the best way is demonstrated by the fact that neither the first Davidic Solomonic kingdom, with its one kind of social structure, nor the Northern Kingdom, with its other kind of social structure, became a viable way to be a holy people. Don't expect to be back from Babylon anytime soon. Live there, buy land, plant vineyards, marry your children, enjoy your grandchildren. Seek the peace of that city where God has put you. So in a broad sense, typified just by this Jeremiah, the prophets were critiquing the failure of the various structures of the Israelite experience, Davidic kingdom, Northern kingdom, later the renewal of an establishment under Nehemiah and Ezra with temple and religious rulings but not political sovereignty. And none of that worked. And God's promise that he would restore his people may be taken, is taken by many people, as a promise that he wants to restore something like David. But what is it about David that he wanted to restore? After Jeremiah, the dominant Jewish reading for 2,000 years was that God will do that sometime miraculously in his way, but he doesn't ask us to be zealots to do it. The Maccabees were the zealots of that period. They failed, and they're not in the Jewish Bible. They're in our Bible, the Western Catholic Bible. The zealots in Jesus' time tried it and failed. Jerusalem was destroyed because of the zealot wars twice, in the 60s and in the 130s. Most of the prophets are critiquing the inadequacy of the effort to be political nationalistically, ethnically, royalistically, waiting for a way to be the people of God in the dispersal, in mission, in suffering, which we have beginning with Jeremiah, in the latter parts of the book of Isaiah, and in some of the other Christological visions of the Old Testament prophets.
Yes, George? No, pardon me, go ahead. This woman is first, in the black dress. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You alluded just briefly to women. Did you, 15 years ago, write anything in your book about Jesus' relationship with women?
This particular book has a chapter on what I referred to in Paul and Peter about reciprocal subordination. So, man, wife, parent, child, master, slave, those pairs and how they are spoken to by the apostles, I analyzed at some depth and demonstrated that that is an affirmation of the dignity of woman and the slave and the child rather than a put-down. I didn't talk about Jesus and women in that particular text, but at the same time, we had at our seminary a course running in which I was the faculty person. Five women made the curriculum, and I just gave grades so that it could be validated. And in connection with that course, I found more than I had seen before about the way in which Jesus was a feminist. So I was seeing and saying those same things at the same time. It didn't fit in the frame of this book. But the way in which Jesus himself dealt with the women on his path was like what is then distilled into a general social teaching in those passages about reciprocal subordination.
George Smith, I think you're next.
Professor Yoder, how do you regard the ancient historian Professor Smith's view that Jesus, in some respects, was regarded as a magician?
I welcome any historian's effort to use a new model or a new type in order to tease out of the ancient documents anything more that we can see. And that includes asking all the questions of what type of social function is going on. Certainly there was something in Jesus of a wonder worker. I'm not sure that's the same as musician, though, a magician. That is, in especially the early parts of the Gospels, the fact that there were healings and exorcisms is a major part of his validation. I don't think I would follow any one model of that ancient time so much as to set aside the other models. And it seems to me quite abundantly clear, just quantitatively, in the gospel story, that Jesus is functioning much more often in the role of leader of a social movement, of leader of a group of people, sometimes in the teaching role as rabbi, but also sometimes in a kind of figurehead role as the one people say they are disciples of. There's much more of that than there is of wonder working. But any kind of aid to historical realism in thinking what was really happening in the first century is better than to use the scriptural sources as just a mine, as I was saying it, for nuggets and diamonds that we want to use for our as proof texts for our modern debates.
Kent?
To take a contemporary issue, say nationalism, and let's be more specific to that, let's say the nuclear arms race, what do you see as the Jesus option in that issue is? If we don't flee into the desert, there's no desert to flee to. If we don't accommodate, how do we accommodate? Well, what do we do in the Jesus sense?
And the question is to have me speak to a contemporary example, the nuclear arms race as a specimen of nationalism. We can't go to the desert because that's where the emigs are supposed to be. What can we do? Can we work with the establishment and hope that it'll be just a little less brutal? I would say there are two fundamental statements. They coincide rather largely, but they can be made separately. One is that nationalism, it is the notion that the meaning of history is carried under God by one particular geographical, political, ethnic entity, more than by others, is itself rejected by the way Jesus and the apostles dealt with the Jew-Gentile problem, dealt with that problem. And I say that's a prototype for all ethnicity problems. Before you can have a war, you have to have nationalism. And nationalism itself is, from a New Testament perspective, I think, idolatrous, even if the nation is not waging war, even if the nation is not imperialistic, and all the nations we know are imperialistic when they can be, and certainly ours has been. So, before the question of military violence, and before that question has escalated into nuclear military violence, the definition of who we are as a people organized in a nation state stands under Jesus' judgment. If we ever think that a fellow American is more important to me than a Soviet citizen or a South African or an Asian, more important to me as a person for whose life I would give mine, more important to me because I want to defend the privileges that we have in common against the poverty of those other people. So nationalism itself is, first of all, a vice from a Christian perspective, or an idolatry. But then once we do have structures, and once we do have enemies, certainly one of the things that Jesus said most clearly, I said the least of it because I spend most of my time in other circumstances saying more about that, we are to love specifically enemies. Enemies are the specific test of whether our love is like God's love. That's the way chapter 5 of the Sermon on the Mount ends. We are to be perfect as God is perfect. Now, ever since John Wesley, there have been half a dozen different meanings of perfection running around radical Protestantism. I don't mean to discuss any of them because none of them are what Jesus is talking about. Jesus is talking, as the text says, about the way God is perfect when God does not discriminate between his friends and his enemies. And we can share that perfection. We can't be sinless, we can't be omnipotent, we can't be like our Father in many other ways, but we can be without discrimination in how we deal with friends and enemies. That's the escalation of the meaning of love of neighbor that Jesus brings about in the Sermon on the Mount. And that means that even once it is the case that there exists enmity, enemy units, and if it were clearly the case, I'm not sure it's that clear, that the Soviet people are my enemies, I'm to love them. So the fundamental theological answer to the question of what to do about any kind of national militancy is to stop it, to disavow it, not simply to call it bad political judgment, but to call it idolatry. That doesn't mean we can keep it from happening, because just like Jesus couldn't keep the Romans from doing whatever they were doing with their statues of Diana and Venus, but at least his people didn't have anything to do with that system. There's one change in the modern setting which has reopened these questions for many of us, many of you, and that is that even those for whom nationalism is not wrong, and even those for whom violence in the service of national interests is not wrong, are beginning to see that modern weapons are dysfunctional even for national selfishness, because they backlash, because we'll get the fallout, or we'll get the second strike. So now there are utilitarian reasons for not wanting an arms race. There are selfish cost-benefit reasons for not wanting an arms race. And that has reopened the discussion in interesting new ways, which make a difference if you're a cost-benefit utilitarian. They shouldn't make any difference if you're a disciple of Jesus.
We have time for just one more question, and I'm going to reserve that one for myself. Moving from the national and the global to the personal, I'm interested in your thinking about this matter of Jesus' inversion of the idea of rank, where the leaders become the servants. Because it is so easy, it seems to me, for any of us individually who may serve in one leadership position or another to see what we're doing as truly serving the people, where in fact we may be exercising an arrogation of power. Napoleon saw himself, I'm sure, as a servant of the French. Gandhi is a servant of the Indian people, and yet they serve in vastly different ways. How are we personally to know whether in fact our leadership, in whatever roles we may play, is an inversion of rank, and that we find ourselves as servants rather than masters.
There are a number of different resources, and I don't think there's any need to choose among them or ask which is true and the other's not. Certainly there are elements of the cultivation of style and spirituality where I can help myself be humble by cultivating my openness to certain questions, my openness to persons, my meditation on my failures and my sinfulness. There are inward disciplines like that that help. But I think there would be from the New Testament more value in two other kinds of corrective, and I mentioned one of them specifically, is actually due process, provisions. Don't act until you've heard everybody. Have structures for hearing everybody before you make a decision. That's what 1 Corinthians 14 says. 1 Corinthians 12 says something else, which is also important and which I'd add because that wasn't mentioned before. It says that every member of the community has a distinctive gift. Not just that everybody ought to help somehow, but every person has her or his specific charisma, gift of the Spirit, and each person should exercise that gift. That means that I can define, if I'm a leader, what it is that I'm obligated to expect to receive from her, and from him, and from you. It means that with regard to myself, special clarity on in Romans 12, you should know what your gift is so that you can exercise that gift. The combination of the affirmation that every person has a gift and that the community is not ready to act until everybody has been heard, seems to me to have a very powerful formal contribution to the answering the question of how to keep the servanthood of leaders from becoming a euphemism for something else.
Yep. I'm going to take one more liberty and have Reverend Horace McMullen ask his question before we retire from our...
Politics of Jesus led to his crucifixion, a unique kind of death, a death of unique meaning, but also to the martyrdom of many of his followers, and according to legend, all of the 12. Is that a necessary component of following Jesus for us? It is surprising when we read the New Testament perspective, our long theological history of developing doctrines of the atonement, which talk about the uniqueness of the death of Christ, it is striking how often the New Testament says that we are to be participating in the death of Christ in various ways, sometimes more symbolic, sometimes more literal. One whole chapter of my Politics of Jesus is just a collection of texts from every strand of the New Testament in which some way or other the crucifixion is a model for our life. Said differently by Paul or by Peter or by James or by John of Revelation, but it's there in every strand of the New Testament. That doesn't necessarily mean that physical death will happen for everybody, but it does mean that for all of the early Christians, their relationship to the powers of the world was one of sharing in the meaning of the cross. That could mean personal death. It could mean other kinds of sacrifice and suffering. It could mean exile. It could mean slavery. And it did for a lot of them. But it was combined with resurrection and Pentecost and the creation of a new community of mutual solidarity so that they thought it was worth it. They thought it was a valid way to live in the shadow of the cross, in the power of the resurrection. But yes, the cross is a model for the life of the believer according to the whole New Testament.
Professor Yoder, you have taught us, you have caused us to think, and you have inspired us, and we thank you very, very much.